You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Dry weekend of not having connecting the dots in your ears. We're back now. And so our long national nightmare is over. Return to the air. And we're here today on this fine Monday to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective with our good friend, Sherry Antonetti.
Hello, Sherry. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing okay. This I think I might be coming down with something. It's kind of weird, but I just like have not been able to pull it together all day. It just can't. I don't know. Yeah. Have you ever had one of those days where you just wake up? I mean, I went to bed at 10 o'clock last night and I got up about 6. So that was, what is that, 8 hours?
Yeah, you know? that's good.
That's 8 hours. Like respectable sleep, you know?
Yes.
And I had the CPAP going and everything, but I woke up this morning exhausted. And I have been exhausted all day and just not feeling 100%, you know?
Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, yeah, my daughter told me about how if you wake up during your REM cycles that you actually will have trouble being awake all day. And yeah, there's actually a website where you calculate when to go to bed so you know when to wake up so you won't interrupt a REM cycle so you'll have better sleep.
Well, that, wait a minute. What? How do you calculate when you're going to? Well, okay.
It's a website. I don't know.
Okay, with like an alarm clock, I suppose. But I mean, I don't calculate when I wake up. I just wake up. And yeah. But today, I just I don't know. I'm just feeling not tip top. So I don't know what's going on. Well, you know, God is good, and so we just soldier on. But this past weekend, here in Seattle, was Deathstorm 2016.
Okay, what does that even mean?
It was, well, to hear them predicting it last week, it was going to be the apocalypse. This is just going to be one of the biggest storms to ever hit Seattle. And we get out here now and then in the winter are these gigantic wind storms that will strike. And they, for some weird reason, they tend to hit on name days, although this one didn't. So there was the Columbus Day storm in 1962 that was just this epic windstorm that went, it killed like 45 people.
And, wow.
And it was just this, and this is before they had like satellites or, you know, modern meteorology technologies. So
Before the weather could be a preemptive story.
Yeah, right. And so it just came out of nowhere. Nobody was expecting it. Just devastated Western Washington. And then, you know, we get those now and then. There was another huge one on inaugural day in 1993, which people read tremendous biblical significance.
Oh, geez.
Into this, you know. And it knocked our power out for 3 days. Some parts of the state, the power was out for 2 weeks. And it was just this, again, just this gigantic, epic windstorm. And so we get these now and then. There was one, there's one called the Hanukkah Eve storm a couple of years back that came.
Great
correct.
Great copy. Really good names. Yes. Okay.
Yes. Just, well, you know, the Jews, what can you do? I mean,
oh, that's terrible. Oh.
So anyway, blew out all those Hanukkah candles. That's what it did. But anyway.
All those parentheses.
So last week they were saying we're going to get this 1-2 punch. This huge storm is going to come rolling in. It's going to hit us with a whammy on Thursday night, and then there'll be a pause, and then on Friday, and then there's going to be this a pause, and then the real devastation will begin on Saturday when Deathstorm 2016 strikes Seattle. So we're all prepped for this storm. People rushed out and they bought all their canned goods and they did all this stuff and everybody got ready for the giant storm. And my big plan, I live about 5 miles from Puget Sound. There's a little town called Edmonds that's this kind of, you know, artsy, wealthy retiree town.
Okay.
Where you can, it's the place you go to get a very expensive latte and then go window shopping for arts and crafts things that were made that sell for an exorbitant amount. And then you drive down or you walk down really. And get on the ferry boat, and you can take the ferry across the Sound and go over to Kingston. So it's a lovely place. I gotta say, I love Edmonds. I really do. And Johnny, I thought, we're gonna have this giant storm coming in, and I'm gonna go right down to the waterfront on Edmonds, and I'm gonna watch these colossal waves smash against Edmonds, and it's going to be so cool to watch. A couple of years ago, we had one of these epic storms. In fact, I think it might be the Hanukkah Eve storm that I'm thinking of. Up the shoreline a little bit is a little town called, I'm not making this name up, Mukilteo.
Great name. I love it.
Isn't that a great name? So Mukilteo, we had one of these epic windstorms that came blasting in, and it was such a huge storm that the waves that came crashing in right next to the ferry terminal is there's a local restaurant chain of seafood restaurants called Ivers, and there's this Ivers restaurant that sits on top of pilings, has been there since forever. Anyway, this storm, when it came blasting in, the waves were so huge that they came surging in and they smashed up under the pilings of Ivor's restaurant. And they literally lifted the entire restaurant off the pilings and then smashed the whole thing back down onto the pilings. So the whole restaurant had to close the thing down for like months and months and go in and make sure that it wasn't, that it was structurally sound and, you know, repair all the damage. Huge waves. So I thought, this is going to be fantastic. I'm going down to Edmonds. I'm going to watch this. So I go down to Edmonds and it was just like the saddest thing. It was high tide and okay. And then you know, these rollers were rolling in and they were like maybe a foot and a half high and they didn't even like smash the breakwater or anything. And there didn't, was just, it
didn't,
it was
snap
like
a twig.
Big bust. Yeah. I mean, and so the breeze kicked. I walked down to a restaurant and had some dinner and I thought, well, maybe it'll get better. And the wind kind of kicked up for a while. You could hear it howling and stuff. The restaurant was like a ghost town because nobody's going to be out in this weather except for somebody stupid like me. And so I watched the wind kick up for a while. And, you know, the winds, the flags were standing out straight and all that stuff. But then... But then it kind of died down again. So by the time I was done with dinner, I walked out into what was supposed to be Death Storm 2016. It was like a breezy evening.
It was chronic fatigue storm of 2016.
So I was like, I'm writing my congressman, you know? I was promised
a death storm.
I was promised epic destruction. And all I got was a stiff breeze. You know.
Ming the Merciless was thwarted by Flash Gordon, and so you didn't get your death storm. That's what happened.
So all I have to say is climate change sucks. I mean, this is not, it was a big bust. But all of that is to say that you know, God took care of us. It turned out that the storm center like stopped and then made a sharp left-hand turn and headed north. And maybe it smashed into Vancouver Island and, you know, did something fun up there. But down here, we were fine.
Well, we had a parallel situation because one of my children goes to school in St. Augustine, Florida. And so that was the bullseye for St. Matthew, for Matthews, the Hurricane Matthew last week.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was, you know, I'm a veteran of hurricanes. My hometown of Beaumont was smashed up by Hurricane Rita. We took, you know, people in from Hurricane Katrina. The Baldwin Peninsula was destroyed by Hurricane Ike. I know how bad they can be. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at it and I'm looking at, you know, they're evacuating parts of St. Augustine, but not all of St. Augustine. And so I was like worried the whole time because if they're wrong, then there's no place for her, but my child or her friends to go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fortunately they were fine. They were fine. They just thought it was, you know, no big deal because they, you know, had food. They didn't even lose power. But, you know, her college was devastated and, you know, it was like a week before they could get back in and it's still a mess. But yeah. But the news made me quite anxious for the week, to say the very least.
Well, that's the job of the news.
It worked.
Yeah. Yeah. It was funny. I mean, even on the news, they had like people stationed all over Seattle reporting back. We'll talk about it when we return.
Okay.
You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Sherry Antonetti.
Hello.
Sharing survivor stories from Death Storm 2016. We'll be back on Connecting the Dots right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Back to Connect the Dots, Mark Shea. And we're here today with Sherry Antonetti talking about our exciting experiences of brushes with nature's fury. The great thing about living in Washington is that brushes with nature's fury are few and far between. The bad thing about living in Washington is that when nature does, in fact, decide to be furious, get out of Dodge, man, because nature's going to kill you. So we're like perfectly fine for long stretches of human time.
Yes.
But then all of a sudden, Mount St. Helens goes off, you know, and
we are not fine. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, like all of, you know, the whole southeast part of the state is devastated. Eastern Washington is buried in ash and all of this kind of stuff, you know, or we get things like I suppose a lot of people have heard of Crater Lake.
Yes.
Down in Oregon. So Crater Lake is it's a beautiful, pristine, blue, gorgeous, glorious lake. But the way it got to be the way it is, of course, is a few million years ago or a few hundred thousand years ago. I don't know. It just completely blew its stack like Mount St. Helens did. You can go to Eastern Washington. I've actually seen it with my own eyes. You go to Eastern Washington and you look at like road cuttings where they cut through the road. To build a road, and you look at the side of the hill, and it's just like brown dirt, and then suddenly there's like this giant, maybe like foot thick layer of gray dirt, and then below it is brown dirt.
Don't mess with Mother Nature. Yes.
That foot of gray dirt is Mount Mazama.
Wow.
And it just he just buried the entire state that way, you know. And
wow,
you get, you know, the Eastern Washington is the site of probably, as far as they can tell, probably the most deadly catastrophic floodings that ever happened in the history of the world.
Wow.
Because there used to be, if you can actually see it, if you look at aerial surveys of the state of Montana, there used to be this lake that covered basically the whole state of Montana, which
oh
is a
gosh.
Pretty big state. It's like,
yeah,
it's water about like the size of Lake Michigan.
Yeah, that's kind of big.
And what made that lake was this giant ice dam that blocked a couple of rivers up there from receding glaciers from the last ice age.
Oh, my gosh.
So what would happen is that lake, which was full of relatively warm water, was blocked up by an ice dam made of, well, ice.
Yeah.
And periodically, the warm water of the lake would undermine the ice dam. And so the ice dam would just suddenly give way. And a volume of water equal to that of Lake Michigan would suddenly disgorge itself in the space of about 2 days into all of eastern Washington.
Oh, my goodness.
And it would follow the course of what's now the Columbia River. So the Columbia River runs through these giant, this enormous gorge that is on both sides of these giant cliffs of basalt. And right now, it's, you know, when you look at the Columbia River, it kind of looks like a trickle of water that goes through this colossal gorge. Well, when these ice dams would give way, that gorge would be full of water right up to the brim.
Oh, my word.
And the walls of this gorge are like hundreds of feet high. And
intense.
It was intense, and there were people there at the time. There were Native Americans living in that area, and some of them were lucky enough to be high enough on the slope.
Yeah, oh my goodness.
Or up on the top of the coulee so that they would escape. But it must have seemed like the end of the world, you know, if you lived in a place like this.
Well, nothing so dramatic from where I grew up. I grew up in southeast Texas, kind of in a swamp right near the Gulf of Mexico. Lots of swampy, big thicket and alligators and rice fields and, you know, spindle top oil. You know, this is where I grew up. And we would get hit by hurricanes periodically. You know, the famous one at that time was the one that had no name in the year 1900 that destroyed Galveston.
Right.
But when we would hear that there was a hurricane coming, and this is before they all got glammed up and got constantly broadcast on the news, that meant go out. You would go out to the beach with your fishing pole, and you'd go out and you'd fish because you'd catch the best fish of your life. You'd catch speckled trout, redfish, sharks, sand trout, I mean, mackerel, beautiful, beautiful fish. And the water would be absolutely clear and flat. You could see your feet. And normally in the Gulf of Mexico, it's brown. You cannot see your feet.
Okay.
And so when the water would turn cloudy, pull in your line, go home. Get out of Dodge.
Okay. Why would the water get clear before a hurricane? Any ideas?
As far as I understood, it was that because the wind wasn't blowing the surf, all the water was being sucked out there wherever the storm was. And so the Gulf of Mexico normally is churning. You get constant water against the surf. And when there's a storm coming, it would get flat like a lake.
Okay.
And so it would get clear. You could see. Because it's very clean water. It just always was moving and churning, and so it would be foamy and brown because of the sand in it. And so there you go.
Live and learn. Yep. Well, you know, that's you just kind of have to, you know, you trust God for these things. I watch the news. The last time we had like something resembling a real disaster strike Washington was the Ash Wednesday quake in 2001.
Okay.
I was sitting here at my desk tippy typing away, and there was this bang, and I thought it was like, it was sort of like something hit the side of our house.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, is that a big truck? Because that was the only thing I could think of, was like a, like compression brakes on a truck that went off like right outside of our the street by our house or something.
Mm-hmm.
I thought big truck, and then I felt, you know, my chair was kept shaking. I thought, no, that's an earthquake. So I walked out into the living room, and it was just like standing on the deck of a small boat in choppy water. And
yes.
And so the floors, you know, doing this weird wavy thing that cement floors aren't supposed to do.
Right. Yeah, that would be wrong. Yeah. Yes.
And I stood there, and Jan was sitting on the couch. She was homeschooling our little ones, and Sean fell on his bum. He was about, I don't know, 4 years old or something when this happened. And so we just kind of stood there praying, and it got. You kept thinking, okay, now it's got to let up, but then it got like more intense.
Yes.
And so you're sitting there thinking, don't fall down around us, house. That would be not good, because we live in a cinder block house.
Uh-huh.
So it's just nothing but cement to fall on you if it decides to go. So we sat there and just kind of waited it out. And I think it must have gone on for like a minute or so. It was a good long.
But it felt longer. It felt longer because you have no idea when it's going to end.
Yeah. And so we just stood there praying. And that was kind of it. And Sean was convinced that Jen had stopped the earthquake with her prayer.
That's good.
Yeah. And so it was like, okay. So then, you know, once it was over, we went out and walked around the house and, you know, tried to make sure that there weren't like big cracks in the wall or that the thing was about to, you know, collapse on us or something. Everything seemed fine. And then you tried to call people to see if they're okay. And of course, the phone lines are just jammed. There's just no getting on the phone.
Right.
And so I came back to my computer and went online because we hadn't lost power or anything. And then the news articles started. And the news, you know, for the rest of Washington, once it was over, the only people who suffered in that quake were insurance companies.
That's kind of good.
So that was good, you know. But the news was hilarious because, you know, the news rushed out and they're downtown mostly because that's where the news people are, is in urban areas.
Right.
So they took pictures from like every conceivable angle of this one old building that had collapsed and dropped a bunch of bricks on this unfortunate red sports car that was sitting out front of the building. And so they took pictures of that car from like 50 different angles, and that was the news that night. And so the rest of the country was like, had this impression of just like The Walking Dead.
Because there are no structures left in all of Seattle. It's all flat. It's all gone.
And what you really did after this quake was you went and you hung out with all of your friends. Uh-huh. And everybody cracked open, you know, a bottle of wine. And then we all told stories about what, you know, what were you doing when the quake happened? So we all told our stories and had a wonderful time.
Yeah. So our earthquake party.
Okay. Yeah. Earthquake party. Everybody, nobody had much suffering except for insurance companies. And, you know, who cares about them? So we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Antonetti.
Hello.
And we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Sherry Antonetti. We've been talking about Death Storm 2016 and what a disappointment that was. And
mostly dead.
Yeah, mostly dead. But last week, I wasn't here, and that's not because I was feeling under the weather. It was because my wife and I had decided that it being Columbus Day and all, or Indigenous Peoples Day, as we call it here in the state of Washington. They've renamed it. Now it's like both, because I'm not sure why. I don't really care. It's like, sure, why not an Indigenous Peoples Day? I mean, Indians, Native Americans are like the most screwed over of all of our minorities. So I have no problem with Indigenous Peoples Day. We decided that it being whatever it's called here in Washington, it was a day off.
Yes.
And so we thought, you know, driving around Washington, the mountains in the fall, seems like a really great idea. And we hadn't done that in ever so long. And the Saturday before last Monday, we had this like marriage enrichment thing at our parish, and a couple came in, and they were like this adorable older couple who were like their 70s or something, and so they were talking about marriage enrichment, and they gave us homework assignments to go and have discussions and things. And so we thought, let's take all that with us and then go drive up around the mountains and go see the fall foliage and experience the glories of Middle Earth, where we live.
Yes.
We do basically live in Middle Earth, especially in Western Washington. It's really, it's quite Middle Earthian. Mm-hmm. So that's what we did. So we drove up, we took we got off the freeway as fast as we could, went back through the back country. We drove past, you might recall a couple of years ago, there was this like huge landslide that buried this community called Oso.
Yes.
And so we took the road that drives right past that. So we saw that landslide, and it is pretty formidable. I mean, it was just this huge section of a hill that's just not there anymore. And so we drove up through there, and then we caught what's called the North Cascades Highway, and drove up over the mountains, and then down on the other side of the mountains, there's a valley called the Metau Valley. And so we stopped in one of the little towns there and got some ice cream and drove. It was just great. And we drove back up into the hills and got up past the snow line. So that was good. And tasted a bit of pre-winter cold up there, and then went all the way down to a little town called Wenatchee, which is on the Columbia River, and drove along next to the Columbia River for a good long while, and then eventually took the highway back over the pass and back to Western Washington. So it was about a 400-mile drive.
Good road trip.
It was a great road trip, and the whole time that we're doing it, we're working on our marriage homework assignments. So we're talking about it was basically discussing the cardinal virtues and the theological virtues, and you know, where are we practicing them in our marriage? Where can we do it better? And it was just a fantastic way to spend a day.
Sounds great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was just a delight, and we got to, you know, talk about some serious things and just spend some time kind of working on our marriage, which I think is really important for people to do. A lot of people forget that marriages require work. They don't just kind of sail along on automatic pilot.
Yeah.
And so I was really I was grateful for the day, and I was grateful that Jan thought about how to do the day so that we're not just looking at leaves.
I get it. It's you know, what you say is true. I mean, marriage, like good parenting, like good teaching, like good anything, it has a deliberate quality to it. It can't just be organic. You know, gardens have to have deliberate qualities to them. So yeah. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. I was glad we did it. And so all of you guys out there in radio land, highly recommended,
plan a road trip
and, you know, maybe bring a book to read. You know, that's one of the things that we talked about doing, actually, was finding something that we could read to one another. Reading books to each other is a great way to build up your marriage, depending on the book, of course.
You're going to say, what book? That could be an issue.
Well, actually, she's joined a book. Jan's joined a book club, and they've been reading Pilgrim at Tinker Creek by Annie Dillard, which is just a fantastic book. Highly recommend Pilgrim at Tinker Creek.
Okay.
So it's kind of partly a science, nature, observation book, and partly this theological meditation.
I like the combination.
Yeah, yeah. She's Annie Dillard is just, she's a hell of a writer. is she good. She used to live out here, actually, on San Juan Island. She taught writing.
Oh, see, that sounds like such a writer life. I live on an island, you know?
Yeah, truly. Yeah, San Juan Island is, all the San Juans are places that attract writers. And so they'll get some little cabin somewhere and write a book. And so anyway, Annie Dillard, she's written other things, but I think Pilgrim at Tinker Creek is one of her best books. And by the way, if you're out there listening and you want to join the conversation, please give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And you can text us at that number as well as call us, and you can tweet us at Breadbox Media. So have you been to any good parties lately?
Well, actually, yes, I hosted a good party. Nice segue. I hosted a party for 12 11-year-old girls on Friday night. And
wow.
What do you do with 12 11-year-old girls? You hold a Halloween fashion party. That's what you do. We had two karaoke machines. We hung up lights. We got some good Euro pop kind of music strobing in the background. And we did color commentary like, you know, Rita is looking very fetching in her Cadmus inspired Hunger Games Rangers look. You know, it's a rainbow unicorn. What more could you ask for, ladies and gentlemen? You know, we had a lot of fun. And then we played, you have to play thematic games. So we couldn't just play, you know, red light, green light. We played Weeping Angels. You know, and we didn't do just freeze tag. We had zombie tag.
Yeah.
So if you got touched and you turned into a zombie.
Okay.
And so the last person standing was the one who won.
Do you get to bite the person next to you, or
no? But you get to put your arms out like a Frankenstein and kind of say, "Lots brains, lots of meat." You know?
Okay, well, that's
it was yeah. That it was a lot
like
of fun.
That sounds was, like fun.
It was properly insane.
Yeah, our little granddaughters are two. Well, how should I put it? Our oldest granddaughter. Is she's at the age where she can appreciate jokes now.
Oh boy.
So you'll tell her some pun and she'll like, it'll dawn on her. She'll get it. And she thinks you're a genius when you tell her some pun that's just got whiskers on it, you know? I don't care. As long as she thinks I'm a genius, that's good. And
there's lots of dad jokes out there that you can milk for a long time.
And so she's got a ton of them too. So she'll come and she'll tell me, you know, some joke that is hundreds of thousands of years old,
and it's still funny.
And well, yeah. And then you go, I give up what? And then she'll give you the punchline, and you'll laugh your head off, and she's so pleased.
Yeah, too. I love when they start making up their own jokes. They've got the concept, but they don't have the reality. Right. So you'll get things like knock, knock.
Who's there?
Car wash. That's it. There's no more of the joke. That's it.
Yeah. When Lucy's dad was a little kid, he did this. He really loved the idea of jokes, and he loved when people told him jokes if he was able to get the joke. But so he figured out the structure of a joke, but he didn't know the content of a joke.
Yes.
So he would come up, and it always revolved around ducks. It was always a duck joke. So why did the duck walk on the ceiling?
Oh, gee.
And you would say, "I give up, Luke. Why did the duck walk on a ceiling?" And then you go, "Because he read a book."
Oh gosh, it's like the back of my car completely. Oh gosh.
Yeah. It was a
yes.
Oh, that's
and it never gets old. And they repeat them. Yes.
I will tell you when we get back the joke that his younger brother told.
Oh boy.
Which is epic. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti. And we'll be back right after this.
See you.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You can call or text us at that number. You can also tweet us at Breadbox Media. And I was going to tell you the
Matthew joke.
My kids were on their joke-telling jag.
Yes.
As young kids, when they first started to get the whole joke concept.
Yes.
Luke was always telling these jokes, and they always involved a duck. So there was always, why did the duck walk on the ceiling? Because he read a book joke.
There
and
you
we
go.
All laugh, or, you know, there was this duck that did this, or knock, knock, who's there?
A duck. A duck, yes.
And, and so one day, my wife, I was downtown Seattle for something or other, and my wife comes to get me, and in the back seat there's Luke and his little brother Matthew, and Matthew's not even quite 1 year old yet.
Oh boy.
And he's just learning to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And well, he must have been a little bit older than one if he was just learning to talk, but at any rate, I get in the car. And Matthew's got the bink in his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
But he talks through the bink.
And okay.
So he clenches it in his little tiny teeth. And so anyway, I'm sitting in the front seat, and I'm talking to Jan, and we're exchanging greetings and kissing and how was your day, and et cetera, et cetera. And from the back seat, I hear, "Dad, Dad, 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 Dad," bink.
Yes.
So I turn around. I say, "Yeah, Matthew, what?" So he pulls the bink out of his mouth and goes, "A duck."
And you knew it was a joke.
Yeah, that was that was the best part of it. It was like, okay, mission accomplished. What a great joke.
That is awesome. I love it. That is really cute.
So it's fun when you watch little kids, you know, you watch the little tiny brain developing and figuring out humor. And that is so fun to watch. Watching little kids figure out jokes and humor and all that. So Lucy, who is 7, is getting quite advanced.
Okay. So, go ahead.
No, that's all. It's just, okay. Lucy's figuring things out now. She's the oldest, and she's getting things quite advanced. Seraphim hasn't figured out jokes yet, but her dad, well, her dad kills her. She thinks he is hilarious.
That's great. That is awesome. So, well, I will tell you that my son, Paul, he's not verbal, but he gets jokes, and he gets, or at least he gets the idea of jokes. Like if you put on something that's slapstick, he laughs hysterically, mm-hmm. and he laughs every time. mm-hmm. But he also gets that laughter is not always benevolent. So his younger sister got in the car, and he had a little stuffed toy elephant, and she had had a toy elephant, and he had taken it. So he had now had two elephants, and he looked at her, and he has almost, I'd say maybe 50 words total. But he looks over as she's in her car seat, and he's in his, and he goes, "Heh heh." And, you know, she's like, "Mom, he's heh-heing at me." And I don't know how to deal with that. It's like, stop heh-heing at your sister, you know. you know, just split up the elephants. But I mean, but he's just looked, and then afterwards, he would just look over and go, "Heh-heh," and she'd start crying. It's like, you don't look as innocent, you know, you look much more innocent than you actually are, you know.
Yep. I'm trying to remember how far back my sense of humor goes. That's a tough one. I mean, it just seems like mm-hmm. I've always found things were funny, but I know there has to have been a time where I had to figure out all this stuff myself, you know. I had, like, the joke books. My brother had, for a long time, I don't know if he had a subscription or what, but we used to have this giant pile of old Mad magazines.
Oh, yeah, those are the best.
Yeah, in the house where I grew up. I mean, I think my sense of humor was probably formed by Mad magazine, which I don't know what that says about me.
But well, those were forbidden. Or those were like, you know, we had to go over to the neighbors to read those.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. She didn't. My mother wouldn't let them in the house, but they okay. did. We did get them at the beach or at, you know,
yeah.
at the dentist or wherever.
So forbidden fruit.
Yes.
Well, see, I wasn't raised in a good Catholic household. there was. Yeah. For some reason, my brother Mike had just hundreds of these things, and they stretched from about 1964. The oldest one that we had a like a spoof or not a spoof, but it was like it was some article that was introduced by JFK.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
It was published like a couple of months after Kennedy's death.
Oh, my.
Just because that was how it was in production. You know, and so yes. It came out in, I think, like February of 1964 or something. And it had just like this one brief reference to JFK. And then they went on until like about, I think like 1972 was about the last of them that we had. And then he went away or I stopped buying them or whatever. And so it was like this time section of the 60s. Golly, we had those things. I must have read them 1,000 times when I was growing up. And it's just one of those weird things. So that I think that had an influence on the things that I thought were funny. And
yeah, I had a collection, but it would have been from the mid 70s. And then the other thing that I discovered was the Irma Bombeck books. And I read those over and over and over and over again, probably preparing for being a mother of 10 at some way.
I read, well, in addition to Mad Magazine, the other things that were influential on my sense of humor were I had 50 zillion Charlie Brown books when I was growing up.
I get those at the library all the time. I totally
And I used to like I don't know, I would like trace them, and you know, I learned how to draw from tracing Charlie Brown cartoons. And yeah, it was just this odd thing. And then, you know, you get older and you figure out more sophisticated humor. And I remember watching Saturday Night Live when it premiered.
Oh, wow.
Because I'm super old. And
I wasn't going to say anything.
That, you know, Saturday Night Live has been, it's like this venerable institution. I think I probably stopped watching it, though, like sometime in the mid 80s. I had other things to do. You know?
Right. Well, it also got to be kind of lame at one point. Had some weak years, some bad vintages.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I must have missed that. They seem to be doing okay right now.
That's true, but they're
a threat to Donald Trump. So, you know, what else can you ask for as far as humor goes?
Well, Saturday Night Live is at its best whenever it's a political season, because they just have more fun with that than they do with anything else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, but yeah, it's fascinating to watch how people's sense of humor develops and the kind of sense of humor that they have, you know, the sort of humor that you get from a Garrison Keillor is not the kind of humor, you know, that you get from Chris Rock or.
True. Well, because Garrison Keillor is a poet and a storyteller first. That's what right. his primary mode. I had the privilege of hearing him at Irma Bombeck Writing Conference, and he was the honored guest at the Irma Bombeck Writing Conference in 2008.
Okay.
And he always is a storyteller. That's how his humor always is. You get to listen and wait for the punchline. Mm-hmm. Whereas others are more like immediate stand up, or, you know, how fast can I get to the next joke? Kind of rapid fire.
Yeah. And then you get geniuses like, you know, Stephen Wright, who, all of his stuff is just like a single line, practically. You know, I put spot remover on my dog. Now he's gone.
Yeah. No, that's very dry. Very good.
Yeah. So it interests me to watch how our kids' sense of humor developed. All of our kids are very different people. Our third son, Peter, is so fun. He's like a big golden retriever. He's big and fun and happy and always, bouncing around and excited and joyful. And, it's such a pleasure to tell him a joke, 'cause he will always just erupt in laughter. Everything is hilarious.
That's nice. That is nice. Well, I have one, a Peter as well, but his humor is more visual. Like, he was helping make cupcakes for his sister, who was sort of his arch nemesis when he was in when he was in seventh grade, and she was in fifth. So they were pink cupcakes with pink frosting. He put little X's so that it was like a smiley face that had died on some of the cupcakes. Just.
That's wonderful.
It was awesome.
Well, listen, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Sherry. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. Our producer today was Danny Head. And we will be back on Breadbox Media tomorrow with Mr. Michael Litchens. Until then, have a wonderful evening. Bye-bye.
See you next.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.